words.
Embrace your feminine power. Welcome to Resurrecting Venus with your host, Cynthia Ocelli.
Hello and welcome to the Resurrecting Venus Show. I'm Cynthia Ocelli and I thank you for tuning in this week. We have an enormously important show for you today. We will be speaking with Bronnie Ware, the author of The Top 5 Regrets of the Dying. This is a pre-recorded interview because Bronnie is calling in all the way from Australia. So we won't be taking calls, but I have received some great questions from many of you for her. So sit tight and really hear me when I tell you that this is a book, an interview that you want to give your full attention to. With every fiber of my being, I want you to listen, I want you to read this book, and let it burn away all of the nonsense we're so often immersed in so that you can really start living the life you came here to live. Now, normally I share a little bit about what's going on in my world, but I really want to have this time with Bronnie today. So I just want to tell you two things. One, my new ebook, Manifesting Your Heart's Desires, is up and available to you free on my site at cynthiaocelli.com. And two, I am very excited to share that I am participating in the Radiant Mama Telesummit. I'm talking about feminine energy, the role of a mother, and the importance of maintaining your identity while being a mother. And actually, how do you do it? You can learn more at theradiantmama.com. If you're a mom or planning to be one, I hope you will join me for this empowering and free event. Again, it's theradiantmama.com. All right. In anticipation of this interview, I have been reading Bronnie's book, The Top 5 Regrets of the Dying, every night before I go to sleep. And this is her uplifting memoir about the years she spent caring for dying people. It is really, honestly, one of the very most important books I have ever read. I just finished it. And as I reflect on it, the title just can't encompass all that this book contains. And honestly, I don't think that any one title really could. Certainly, the top five regrets of the dying are a major through line of this book, but there is so much more, as you will see. Each time I read this book, I started with a mind just full of thoughts about dying and grief and saying goodbye. But every time I put it down, I was overflowing with a new resolve to really live better and more boldly, and to really honor my truth. So rather than tell you all about the book myself, which I totally could, but that would pale in comparison to having the author, the woman who's lived these amazing stories herself, tell you about it. I am really honored and grateful to welcome Bronnie Ware to our show today. Welcome, Bronnie.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Your book and your life are really magnificent. And there's so many things to talk about. So I just want to jump in, and I wanted to kind of jump in at the beginning, which is so amazing and bizarre to me. You had a career in banking. You were a corporate person. How did you get from there to caring for dying people?
Just the pain of work dissatisfaction drove me to it. I was looking for work with heart, and went through a lot of searching, and eventually got onto the creative path, and decided that I wanted to live without rent or a mortgage. And so I took a live-in job as a carer, thinking it would help me have time to work on my songwriting and photography and anything creative I came up with. And as it turned out, the first lady that I cared for in Australia became terminally ill, and I was with her at her death, and so it just opened up a whole different world to me. And little did I know, it was actually going to be a significant part of my life's work.
Wow! Mm. So I'm just overwhelmed with all the places I could go. I wanted to note something that you did that just stood out to me as something so brilliant, and you mentioned it here in your statement. Now, you said you wanted work with heart. And so you made two lists. You made a list of the things you were good at and a list of the things that you loved. And between those two, there's usually a sweet spot for us that we can find ways to actually do that, that it's actually, it becomes very real for us to be able to live and work from our hearts, even if we're not as brave as you are to say, I don't want a mortgage and I don't want any rent.
Yes.
And so you went and you sort, go ahead.
No, it's okay.
You sort of jumped headfirst into caregiving for people specifically who were living in the last weeks of their lives. And you share that you didn't come in with all the answers. You came in very new, again, with a lot of heart. But what was it like the first time you were alone and actually responsible for a dying person's care?
It was quite terrifying. In a way, I was very aware of the honor. You know, I did feel grateful and blessed to be having that life experience. I wasn't oblivious to that, but it was quite terrifying because I really didn't know what I was doing. I was so fresh as a carer, and I didn't know what to expect. But I just trusted that I'd find my way through, and I did. But it was a huge learning experience.
Were you afraid of being there the first time someone died?
I don't know about actually being there and seeing them dying. I don't think that was as scary as hoping that I'd know what to do. More scared about my skills and my ability than actually being with someone when they were dying. Because again, I had trust all the way through that this was meant to be, and so it didn't bother me so much that I was going to see someone die as much as I hoped I'd do whatever needed to be done well. But you know, people actually die on their own, and you don't have to do a lot other than be there for them.
Wow. So. You said something really important. Like everything you said was important, but here's one thing that you said was important. You said that we in our society treat death as a sort of out of sight, out of mind type of experience. And that's really true. We do. We turn away from it and we try to hide what is really an inevitable part of every single life. Why do you think that it's important that we face it and include it in our lives?
Well, it's just being honest with ourselves. I mean, death is a part of the life cycle for so many reasons, really. It just makes you live with heart. If you can face the fact that you are going to die, and you are, I am, we are, every one of us is going to die, it just makes you shift your priorities to what's important. And rather than be driven by fear or ego or be concerned by the opinions of others, whether that's family or peers or society, you actually start living a more authentic life because it gives you courage when you face the reality that the clock is actually ticking and there is limited time remaining. And, you know, it's not something to be terrified of. And if anything, we can use death as a tool for living in a really beautiful way. But I think that as long as we hide it behind closed doors, we're all just, well, not everyone, but generally, the majority, certainly in Western culture, are just driven by the wrong priorities. And it's only when you truly face death that you can find the courage to shift those priorities.
I love that. So that's where the courage really, really is triggered, because it's true. It's easy to, especially in a world of Facebook, fortune cookie posts, it's easy to see all of the wisdom, but it's, we don't grasp it and take it in or believe that it's actually true. It's just pithy, and then you move on with whatever's consuming you in your day. Mm-hmm. And I think that your book masterfully brings it home and brings it to life. And this really, this here, what I wanted to say to you isn't much of a question. It's more of an observation. You take all of the bits of wisdom that we hear all the time and you really lay them right inside the reader's heart, making them real and relatable through stories. And so as you read this book, the reader gets to meet each person. And while there is sadness and rawness, there is beautiful truth and so much real love and light and wisdom. And I just I cannot stress that enough to everyone listening. It's not something that you can, that you just, you know this, but you don't know it until you really let it into your heart and find out what it means for you. And I would argue, and I know you've already argued, that there's probably nothing more important that we can be doing.
Oh, look, we've just got to be honest with ourselves. You know, that's the bottom line of everything. We just have to be honest with ourselves these days.
Mm-hmm. So, did everyone you encounter have regrets at the end of their life?
No, not everyone did. Certainly more did than didn't. Some people were quite accepting of the life they'd led. There were things they would have changed, but they were accepting of the way things turned out. There are a few people who were genuinely happy and satisfied with their overall life, but certainly the majority of people that I cared for did have regrets of some form or another.
Mm-hmm. And did those people die regretting, or were they able to come to some kind of peace?
I think everyone came to some sort of peace. Most because they had time to reconcile things within themselves and to learn a little bit of compassion towards themselves, or just to have time for acceptance. I think that a few others actually, they came to a sort of peace, but I don't know that it was genuine peace, in the sense that it was more of a resignation. They were so ill, mm-hmm. they knew they weren't going to get better, and so they just let go of the turmoil and the angst that they were causing themselves with regret, and just let it go. And I think that was, so in some cases it was genuine peace. In more cases it was genuine peace that they found. But occasionally I think it was just resignation, just accepting, okay, well, I'm too ill now. Who cares? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Out of the top five regrets that you wrote about, is there one that has influenced or changed your life the most?
Oh, great question. yes, I think the third most common one, of people wishing they'd had the courage to express their feelings and to be more honest with their emotions. I think for me, I was very closed and carrying a lot of pain, and I'd build a lot of walls up, and I think that for me to chip away at those walls and eventually knock them down was enormous, and I could only do that by having the courage to start expressing myself and opening up and being honest, and I started seeing through dying people doing this the benefits of honesty. And so, yeah, I'd definitely say that it was the third one that had the most influence on me. Yeah.
That's interesting. I hadn't expected that to be the one, but it, now that I look at it in context, it absolutely makes sense. I received a question from a reader, and I wanted to put it in here because we're on the five regrets, and she wanted to know, what is your view of people conforming to societal expectation versus their own desires?
Sorry, I didn't hear the last half of the question. Sorry.
What's your view of people conforming to societal expectations versus their own desires?
Well, I think that we have to serve our own desires. If we're working from the heart, everyone benefits if we serve our own desires. Self-love is not selfishness. Self-love benefits everybody. And so I think that, if you're living a life just by society's expectations, then chances are you're not really living an authentic life, unless that's the life you genuinely want to live. And so if that's the case, then you're doing both anyway. But generally, I think that it's just so much more important to live that life to your own desires, because that's your heart speaking, and if you're able to honour your heart, then everyone benefits right across the board.
Beautiful. Do you have, this was her second part of the question, what can people do who have thoughts around being guilty, feeling guilty? What can they do? What can they be doing to release the expectations of others and not feel guilty?
Okay, well, for one, we're not responsible for the reactions of other people. So we really have to just try and honour our own feelings and not take on that responsibility. So it starts with compassion for ourselves, and guilt is actually covered in one of the topics in the book, but it is a toxic emotion that doesn't benefit anybody, or the only person it really benefits is who you feel guilty towards if they want to grab power from that, which doesn't, you know, is not real and is not a healthy exchange. So what we need to do is be compassionate for ourselves and look back at whatever we're guilty about, forgive ourselves. But, you know, we really need to forgive ourselves on all levels. And one of the main points, one of the main things I've learned through all of this is self-compassion and how important it is. And so what we need to do is, you know, look back on who we, for whatever you're feeling guilty for, whether it's current or past, look back on who you were or are with compassion from who you are now and just think, okay, well, you know, I don't actually have to be that person. I don't have to carry the guilt. That was who I was. It's not who I, you know, who I am or who I'm going to be. But we don't actually owe anything to anyone else other than to be ourselves, because once we are ourselves, we are our best person for everyone else. So then there would be no guilt necessary anyway. Yeah.
Right. Ah, I love that. So you really stand out as a master of letting go, and you let go in throughout this book. You let go materially, emotionally, spiritually. Can you talk a little bit about what letting go means to you in your life and all that came from it?
Oh, gosh, it's freedom. That's the bottom line. Letting go is freedom. And it's so, you know, surrendering, initially a lot of people, if they're new to letting go, they see it as failure or an easy way out. But it's actually, it takes courage, and it's a huge gift to ourselves to be able to let go. And, I mean, there's so many levels of letting go. There's, you know, as you've just said, there's letting go physically and letting go emotionally. And a lot of it is letting go of the ego and allowing yourself to be who you are and not have to prove a point to other people, you know. That lets a lot of things slide then, when you realise that if you don't have anything to prove, then you can let go of so much and just accept yourself as who you are. Letting go of belongings for me is absolutely freedom.
And you did, down to boxes, right? Down to just a couple of boxes.
Yes, yeah, that fit inside a tiny car. And it's funny now, actually. I had a friend come over the other day. She made me a dessert, and she asked me, did I have a cake slice thing to lift the dessert out of the container? And I said, oh, I'm not sure. I know I gave that away years ago, but I don't know if I've replaced it since. And and I opened the drawer and found something else that would do, but I didn't have one. And, yeah, it's so freeing to let go. And things come back. Whatever you need comes back. And we really don't need everything brand new, because, again, it's only, you know, it's lovely to want quality and comfort. I'm definitely into comfort these days. But it doesn't have to be, you know, a $4,000 lounge. It can come your way secondhand and be just as lovely. And, I just think that if we can detach from our belongings, it does come down to trust and faith that you will attract again what you need. But in my case, it's been one of the most freeing things I've ever done.
You repeatedly demonstrate this sort of universal conspiracy, like you let go of everything and you're living that way for a time. And then when it comes up in you that you want to be grounded and you want to have a kitchen, everything almost just shows up all around you, from the space to the items in the space to everything you need. It just all comes together. And from a quality perspective, when we're talking about material things, it's actually the older things that tend to be of higher quality in many cases now. And you just seem to, in your surrender, magnetize it all to you at the moment that you're ready to create that.
And I think any of us can, if we get fear out of the way and not have that attachment to things. I guess I've always seen myself as, or certainly in the last 20 years, as an artist in some capacity. Mm. And so to me, I don't have the attachment to what the things are really going to look like, because I know that when I blend it all together, it's going to come out as a creative artwork anyway. You know, so it means I don't have to say, okay, this wardrobe needs to be this high or this wide. I just think, okay, well, I need a wardrobe for this space. And sure enough, an antique wardrobe will turn up with, you know, little great legs on it and, you know, a great handle, or I'll get a handle off eBay and fix it up. And but really, do I have to do that? I just seem to have attracted things. And a perfect example was, it was one day I was thinking I needed a pantry, a tall cupboard for my kitchen. And and I went out that day and actually found one by the side of the road. I was going to a garage sale looking for one, and there was just one out the front of someone's house that they were giving away, and it was exactly what I wanted. And I just, you know, I just couldn't believe it. I thought, you know, how easy it is if we get in the flow of it.
Yeah, you demonstrate that, and you say that comes from getting the fear out of the way and really allowing it to happen for you. And what came up for me is, in one place in the book, you shared a time where you, in the midst of taking care of all of these dying people, were grappling with an illness that you chose your own way of healing through emotional and spiritual healing. And you really demonstrate the power of our energy and our willingness and our intention. And it was interesting for me to see that juxtaposed against people dying, because I was thinking, well, you know, couldn't they change it now too? And you address it beautifully in the book, but it's just amazing to me that you're so tapped into your own power of self co-creation and manifesting here in the world as you move through your life.
I think it's the stronger, how do I put this? The more leaps of faith you take, the better you become at it. So it's like anything, you get better with practice. And so I had done a lot of leaps of faith already, where I'd taken off with $50 in my wallet and for a whole new chapter, not knowing where I was going to end up, or ended up on a tropical island for 2 years.
Not bad.
And, no, it's not bad. I know, that's right. there's so many... I've taken a lot of risks, and I think that the more risks you take, the more connected you become with your own power and the universal power. You just realize that, okay, I know that this is challenging, and each challenge I do would be a little bit bigger and a little bit harder, but the rewards would be a little bit bigger. And so I think that has given me confidence to truly trust my own power, because I've put it into action and I see that it does work. It's not just stuff that you read about in books, not just my book, but books that I had read. But it is something that you get better with practice. And so the more you can test your faith and see how this energy flows, then the more daring you become.
That is the perfect space for us to go to a break. And you said something about you get better as you do it. And that's where I want to go next, because you've already lived a bunch of lives in your life, but we're going to go to that getting better as you do it when we get back from the break. Stick around, everybody. We'll be right back. This is the Resurrecting Venus Show. You're listening to me and my beautiful guest, Bronnie Ware, top 5 regrets of the dying. We'll be right back.
Jones.
Embrace your feminine power. Welcome to Resurrecting Venus with your host, Cynthia Ocelli.
Welcome back. This is the Resurrecting Venus Show, and you are joined by my wonderful guest, Bronnie Ware, top five regrets of the dying. And we left off before I move on to what I wanted to talk about. I just want to ask two questions. One, did anyone that you spent time with before they were dying ever regret not having had more stuff or achievements? Bronnie?
Sorry, Cynthia.
Oh, I'm sorry. Let me repeat the question. Do you hear me now?
Yes, I can. Sorry.
Okay, super. Of all of the people that you spent time with as they were dying, did any of them ever regret not having more material items or achievements?
Oh, not one. Not one.
Really?
No, not one.
So in our culture, especially here in my culture, I haven't been to Australia, but in my culture, everyone is driving toward more things and more accomplishments and more achievements. And so would it be reasonable to say that many of us are spending our entire lives and the bulk of our days pursuing things that really don't matter to us?
Absolutely. In a nutshell, yes, absolutely. There were occasions when, what becomes important in that sense of material belongings is people are happy if they've been able to provide for their children. That does bring an element of peace. But providing for their children isn't only materialistic. It's also, there was more satisfaction from when they had taught their children good values. And that came up far more than people wishing they'd left their children more money.
Wow. Well, I hope everybody really listens to that, because to me that's, you've stood at the finish line and you've given the information that you wish you knew, that if only you had known. Now everybody knows, so there's no excuse. This is the time. All right. You mentioned in the book that there was this face of joy that came up as in the time, in the moments, right as many of the people you cared for were dying. Do you have a sense of what happens when you die as far as afterlife or life going on or the spirit and the soul?
I can't not have a belief now, being around that and seeing the jubilation on some people's faces. I just think that that it's love wherever we return to. I don't just think it. I think it has to be a place of beauty and wonder, because the joy I've seen on people and recognition as well. You know, people who have obviously recognized someone or something, and you can see that recognition. And so it's left me with complete peace about dying, because if anything, I perhaps look forward to it, because it's something so beautiful that I think that life here may even pale in comparison.
Wow. I love that. And thank you so much for sharing that. Switching tracks now. You have had so many incarnations in this one life. Reading it was like several stories, and trying to put it all together and imagine how this one woman played all of these roles and showed up in all of these ways and tried all of these things. And just when I think I kind of had a good understanding, it turns out that you are a songwriter, and you were a performer who was terrified of performing. And you go through this whole thing, which many of us can identify with, because, you know, sometimes stepping out there to live your purpose, your passion, or your dream requires you to go through something that you have to grapple with parts you don't want to, you're uncomfortable with, and step way outside of that comfort zone. But that's what you were called to do, and you were called out into the spotlight. Are you comfortable performing now?
I am, definitely. That doesn't bother me at all. But For a few reasons. I don't perform in places that don't suit my music now. That's a big part of it. I've learned to make choices that are healthy for me in that regard. And yes, because my message is clear, and I know that if I'm playing in the right places, then the audience connects with me anyway. So I'm not trying to compete against the boxing on the TV inside a pub or something like that.
Right.
But my life has changed a lot, so I'm not actually performing very much at the moment anyway, and I'm doing a bit of speaking, which I love, because, again, I'm speaking to audiences who get what I've got to say.
Wow. So you've already jumped into another incarnation, but you didn't just dabble in the performing. You have songs and albums, and you took a program into women's jails. I mean, you really develop whatever you're working on.
Yeah, I'm not really able to do anything by halves, I don't think. I haven't found the middle way as such.
Okay, and I love that. I think that's amazing. And I felt that when I read the stories about your experience in the jail, in the women's jail, it was very interesting to me because you came with a very pure heart set on helping and healing and improving their own self-worth. And in the process, you also received a lot of healing.
I did. The women in there just gave me so much kindness that it made me realize that I had a lot of lessons to go through in receiving kindness rather than just giving kindness. And it was wonderful for me.
Mm-hmm. So throughout the book, you go through these tremendous emotional experiences and spiritual growths, and then to me, I'm thinking now is the time that she rides off into the sunset, having reached enlightenment. She is set and good to go. And you fell into what you call a deep suicidal depression. How did this happen, and how did you get through it?
It just happened as if someone unplugged me from the wall and I fell in a heap. It just came out of the blue. I didn't see it coming at all. I guess in hindsight there were signs, but I just had no energy left, and then I just started crying and cried for about 6 months. And I remember going to speak to someone about it, and I said, "Oh, the doctor thinks I've got depression," and I'm crying my eyes out while I'm saying this, and she's saying, "Well, how do you feel about this and that?" And I'm saying, "Yep, yep, yep." And she said, "Well, Bronnie, you have depression." I said, "I don't have depression." You know, crying. But it was just accepting that I was vulnerable too, and that it's okay not to be strong all the time. You can't carry everybody else all the time. So my way through it really was just to hang out in a really beautiful environment. I was renting a cottage by a creek on a huge farm, and I had wildlife around me all the time, birds and wallabies, which are small kangaroos. I had, cows wandering through my front yard, and I just allowed myself the time and cried it out, talked it out a bit, but more I just spent a lot of time in meditation and silence and learned to love me and learned to nurture me in the way that I had nurtured dying people and the women in the jail, and just learnt that Bronnie deserves the love as well. And through, a course of a year or so, I just transformed. But I hit the bottom a few times before I came through that. But when I did come through, I was certainly a completely different person.
You said in there, in your experience, that people around you who were just uncomfortable with seeing you, of all people, depressed, were trying to give you suggestions all the time about, you could try this, and how about this, and you should do this. They were really working hard to try to help you or fix you. And you wrote that what depressed people need the most is acceptance. Can you talk about that?
Yes. Well, that pressure, the pressure is often meant so much out of kindness from people, but it really, it's only their fears projected onto the person suffering depression. And it's just pressure that, as if the depressed person doesn't have enough pressure of their own. They're already dealing with their own head, and their own sadness and pain. And it, you know, it can be a tough love when people say, well, you've got to do this and you've got to do that. But people do, if they genuinely want to get better, they will work their way through depression. You have to want to get better. And I think there comes a time with depression when you get a bit bored of it. You get a bit bored of the pain and wallowing in the sadness. And so if you're going to reach that turning point in your own time anyway, and then you do start moving forward. And so I think that it's a lesson in surrendering for people who love someone with depression, because they've got to trust that person's own wisdom, that they will reach a point where they're going to get better. And mm-hmm. if they don't, then that lack of pressure will still make life easier for the person with depression. And, I have a friend who says he's had depression for 10 years. I personally don't think he really wants to get better. I think that he's identifying with that role that he plays. It takes strength to get better. Depression's a horrible illness, but it's also a beautiful transformation if you decide to take the gifts from it that it really does offer.
Well, you really demonstrate both the darkness and the difficulty that you faced in that depression, but you really showed what it's like after the fire, that it burns so much away so that you could burst forth in your truest, most authentic expression. And it was like the belly of the whale. You kind of had to be there to get here.
Absolutely. It's one of the best things that ever happened to me.
Oh, that's amazing. So does personal growth ever stop? Have you ever found a place where you've arrived, now you're done?
No. No.
Okay. So you're still in process always?
Absolutely, yeah. I think you just become a little bit more equipped to handle it.
Yeah. So one of the most beautiful thing that came from your depression is that you developed this sense of compassion and real, actual self-love. And you manifest that self-love both in your thoughts and even in the physical ways that you took care of yourself. And after you tap into this self-love, your whole life changes. What kind of changes happened after you discovered your love for you?
Oh, gosh, just doors open. Doors burst open. I started teaching. I started singing in children's preschools. I developed a music course for young children. Not a course, a show for young children. So mm-hmm. I was in a joyful place of performing. My work took off just enormously. You know, I started getting quoted in some of the biggest newspapers in the world, and I was just living in my tracksuit pants and living on a farm, and all this stuff just started flowing, pouring to me, just so much goodness, and doors just opened. And then and then I ended up in a relationship, and we decided to have a baby. I was 44 then, and we were blessed to conceive the second month that we tried. And
oh my God.
So 2 weeks before I turned 45, I became a first-time mum, and I now have a gorgeous, gorgeous child, a gorgeous daughter, Eleanor.
Oh wow.
Yeah,
That's just amazing. That first part was amazing. But yeah, I was just going to say, so here we are in incarnation 57, and you're a mom at 44, and you just decided, you know, I think we'll have a baby. And then your second month out, I mean, I'm surrounded by people who are really trying, and they're putting a lot of effort into it, and they're stressed and worried and tense, and it's too late, or it's never going to happen, or I don't know what to do. And you just show up and you have this beautiful baby.
I know.
How did this happen?
I think it's faith. You know, it's just, I believed I was going to be a mum, and I had let go of it at one stage, thinking, okay, well, maybe I'm too old, and this is when I was about 41 or 42, and I'd sort of mm-hmm. becoming a foster parent. And so I guess I didn't really have that attachment to whether it was my child or someone else's child, but But I just knew deep down in my heart that there was a child to come, and I knew it would be a daughter. And I think also I was very healthy physically. So even though I was 44 when I conceived, I may have been quite younger physically. I'd had different addictions over the years. I'd got rid of those, and I was never much into alcohol, but I hadn't had any alcohol in my system for a few years. Didn't drink coffee. I'm a vegan. So I don't know. I think my body was just bursting for it. I don't know, but I ended up having a, 9-pound-8, beautiful, gorgeous baby girl, and she's as healthy as they come. So I think it's faith, Cynthia. I just knew in my heart that it was possible. Which anything is.
Wow. So that dovetails into a reader question that I have, which was, what are your thoughts about age and pursuing your dreams? Can you be too old?
No, never. Never too old. Never. It's so irrelevant. I've met people who have started university for the first time in their life in the early 70s. And I think that you've got to be open, you've got to be flexible to how your dream will come to you. So in my case, I thought, I want a child, but it could have been a foster child or it could have been a stepchild, ultimately I was blessed with having my own biological child. But I wanted to be a parent. That was the dream. It wasn't that I wanted my own child. And so I guess when you're pursuing your dreams, be clear about the feeling that you want, but allow the dream to be creative in its own way and to come to you through whatever channel it's going to come.
So it's interesting you say to be clear about the feeling that you want. So it's not attaching the feeling to a specific outcome. Mm. It's saying, I want to enjoy this experience, and I'll take it how the universe in its brilliance, which is far beyond mine, delivers it to me.
Exactly. Well said. Exactly.
I love that. You really, for anyone who's struggling with this, and I get at least 100 emails a week about this type of frustrated upset for not being able to get where you want to go, read this book. You learn through stories in ways that I could tell it to you in to-do lists, and there's something different about learning through stories and seeing, and it also strengthens and enlarges your confidence that it happened when you know that it happened to someone else. And that I just really want to encourage everyone to get out there and do that. So another question I had for you from a reader, and she happened to have read your book. She said that you have a very strong meditation practice. And how have you been able to keep it through all of these years, and how has it helped you?
I think that self-discipline works for me, and so I made it a priority. I think that's what you have to do, is think, okay, treat it as an essential ingredient, as a medication, not just a meditation, but, okay, this is a pill I have to take every day for my well-being, mm-hmm. and so allow that time in some capacity. When I was writing the book and up until I gave birth to Eleanor, I was meditating for an hour in the morning and an hour in the evening. And if I couldn't find that time, it would be at least half an hour of those. So I'd still make sure that if I couldn't apply myself for as long as I wanted to, at least I would still sit at some time. Once I gave birth, obviously, you just don't have that time. Mm. And so I would use the breastfeeding as a time of quietness, and it's only now that Eleanor's 18 months old that I find that I can get back into some sort of formal meditation again, and it just returns me home. It just brings me back to such a place of peace, and it strips away anything else. We can get on this treadmill, and it's hopping off the treadmill and just getting back to breathing. I'm not talking about the technique. I'm just saying in life, it makes you stop and breathe to do meditation. And so, yeah, I think you just have to treat it like an essential pill that in order that for your well-being, you have to take this pill every day. Yeah.
Is your meditation just a quiet watching of, like a detached watching of thought, or do you have a specific practice or mantras, or how do you approach meditation?
The meditation technique I use is Vipassana. Vipassana is taught all over the world. You go into 10 days of silence and learn it that way. And I have done all sorts of meditation leading up to that, but when I came across the Vipassana path, I realized that it was a technique that just took me so much deeper than anything else had. And so it's observing the sensations within the body and shifting your awareness up and down the body and not reacting to whether it's pain or pleasure, just realizing that both are a part of life, both will pass. But just observe and be peaceful and equanimous with both being a part of life. Yeah.
Is that how you coped with, in many places in the book, you appeared to me as a really deep empath, someone who takes in the energy, including the pain and the upset of those around you. And I was wondering, you know, how could you do that being so open and then still detach and release it?
I think I just learned over time. I don't think I could release it initially. I was quite a burnt out mess after each person died in the early days. Mm-hmm. But I think over time I did learn to detach, and because I loved the people by the time they died, I'd grown close enough to love them. I was happy for them that they'd gone because they were out of pain, and so I could detach in that sense as well.
Yeah. I had to say that I have also seen, unfortunately, nursing homes and caregivers who seem to have disconnected from the fact that they're caring for living beings who are relying on them for comfort and care and love. And you really, I want to just thank you. And you really just, you were so kind and compassionate, and you really upheld their dignity. I loved how you go from very soft, very easygoing, very water and fluid to stand up rigid when anyone's comfort or care was even threatened a little bit. It was really fun to watch the different colors of your personality come up, because you're so ethereal, but then you've got this place in you where you say, this is not right, and I'm going to stand up for it, and you're not getting past me. And I thought it was amazing. And I just, for everyone who's ever taken care of someone, or caring for someone, or seeing someone being cared for, this is a book that will really highlight how to do it in with such dignity and fierce grace that I it was so important. And I thank you so much for how you showed up that way.
Thanks for recognizing it. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I wish it was kind of like mandatory. You should make it mandatory reading for all nursing homes.
I wish.
Really? Mm. Yeah, I know. It's tragic. I know we're running low on time, but I'm going to switch back over to another subject. It just blew my mind, because you, as you're this manifester, you give in, you surrender, you let go, and you decide, I'm taking this direction and this is how I want to feel, and I'll trust the universe and how it shows up. And so you find yourself 44, instant mom, healthy baby. And then in the midst of it, just a day after you're having your baby, you get offered a publishing contract while you're in the hospital. Tell me about that.
My work had taken off hugely, and I was very clear that I wanted to be with Hay House, and I'd looked at Hay House Australia website only 3 weeks earlier, thinking, when are they going to notice me? You know, when are they going to get in touch with me? And it just kept going, getting bigger and bigger, and I was doing interviews from my hospital bed because my work had been quoted in a major newspaper in London, and I was in labour, and I wanted to actually be enjoying this reverent special time, but
Bronnie,
instead I was under all
my
this
dear,
pressure.
I hate to cut you off. My clock just caught up with me. Everyone, I encourage you to go to www.bronnieware.com and get the rest of this story and get this book and read about the question that she was just answering. Thank you so much, Bronnie, for being here, and I look forward to hearing from you in the future.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.